This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Unfortunately, the children of South Sudan have experienced almost every abuse that the adult mind can conjure. Children, they are being recruited. And when a child, of course, is recruited, whether or not they're in the front line, they face risk of death. If they're in the front line, then, of course, they see and sometimes commit unspeakable horrors. Children who haven't been recruited are still in villages that are often under attack. Amid this entire crisis, even those children who have somehow managed to escape violence are living in a state where social services are close to collapse. And if it wasn't for organizations like UNICEF or the World Food Program.
That's James Elder, Regional Chief of Communication for UNICEF in Eastern and Southern Africa. We'll have full details on this story coming up.
Also, Gambia's president-elect Adama Barrow says he is concerned about his safety amid political uncertainty following the December 1st election. And 8 years of violence and conflict in northeastern Nigeria have created one of the world's worst humanitarian crises.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Gambia's president-elect Adama Barrow says he is concerned about his safety amid political uncertainty following the December 1st election. Barrow spoke to VOA's French to Africa service. President Yahya Jammeh is challenging the election results in court despite initially conceding defeat. Barrow says Jammeh does not have any legitimate claim. Barrow told VOA that Gambia's Supreme Court does not have enough judges to hear Jammeh's appeal. He called on the president to accept defeat. This week, four West African presidents met with Jammeh, hoping to persuade him to step down when his term expires next month. ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, meets on Saturday to decide if it will take any action against Jammeh. Jammeh took power in a coup and has ruled the Gambia for 22 years.
Eight years of violence and conflict in northeastern Nigeria have created one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. Among the areas hardest hit by Boko Haram militants is Borno State, where many thousands have died and millions are displaced. In a new report, the World Health Organization says much of the healthcare system in Borno State has been damaged or destroyed. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Dr. Jorge Castilla says the scope of the humanitarian crisis in Borno State is becoming clear as aid workers gain greater access to the region. Castilla is a senior officer for WHO's Emergency Management and Support.
There has been a crisis there for a number of years, and it is only in July and August where a number of surveys were possible because there was more access that we were able to measure to a certain extent the level of mortality and of malnutrition, and we found numbers that are extremely rare because so high and so severe.
It's estimated more than 3 million people in Borno suffer from moderate to severe food insecurity, and many are children. The WHO has increased its staff there and launched an online early warning system for disease outbreaks, like measles. Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states have all been under a state of emergency due to Boko Haram attacks. But most of the displaced are in Borno, so health programs are being strengthened there first.
In terms of numbers, Borno is far ahead in terms of needs. So what we want to do is to focus initially there where the people most in need. And as the levels of mortality and malnutrition begin to decrease, but they are still not at the levels that we would wish for, we are beginning our expansion to the other areas.
The Borno State healthcare system was in shambles due to insecurity, rough terrain, and a lack of healthcare workers, medicine, equipment, and safe drinking water. The UN and its 18 aid partners estimate they need $94 million just to provide health services to the 6 million people in need. The WHO says around 65% of the more than 700 health facilities in the Nigerian state have either been destroyed or damaged. The few remaining are reported intact. However, Dr. Castillo says just because a health center is intact does not mean it's fully operational.
One-third might not be destroyed, but they were not functional because they were on areas where access is impossible, there was no staff, and there was no medicine. Among those that function, only 60% have access to water, and only half of the facilities were able to take care of neonatal problems, which is one of the big causes of death in emergency situations, and only 75% were able to take care of obstetric care for delivering of children.
Castillo says many people don't realize how large the crisis in Borno State is.
If you hear about an earthquake in China, you will see that there will be many people affected because it's a very populated country. Nigeria is a very populated country. People don't understand necessarily how big the problem is here because they don't know that a city like Maiduguri is 5 times more populated than Geneva.
Maiduguri is the capital of Borno State. Solving the humanitarian crisis in Borno requires both short-term and long-term efforts. Castillo says it'll probably take at least 2 years to solve most of the problems.
Given my experience in similar situations, if there is food, care, and there is access, it takes very short time to resolve. It takes weeks, maybe a couple of months. But it is not the reality because food is not sufficient and access is not sufficient and security is not there. So 2 years is an optimistic estimation.
The WHO says in the past, Nigeria would have been better able to handle the humanitarian crisis because of its abundant oil revenues. But low oil prices and attacks by militants on oil production facilities in the Niger Delta have put the nation's economy into a recession. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Joe. From the beginning, the driving motor for Nigeria's homegrown Boko Haram militancy was the abolition of schools that teach what the extremists call Western ideas. Schools in 3 northeast states were burned, Muslim and Christian children alike were kidnapped, and teachers were killed. As Nigerian troops retake these 3 states, relief workers bring food, medicine, and classrooms. VOA's David Arnold has the story about the teachers of Maiduguri.
Boko Haram extremists believe Western education is bad. For 7 years, they targeted schools, the students, and the teachers who stood at the front of the classroom. For several of those years, Abuja journalist Isaac Abrak has reported on Boko Haram's path of destruction. Recently, he investigated what happened to the school teachers in Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State and the center of much of the 7-year conflict.
I spoke to a headmaster who told me his school was attacked on the 28th of June, 2009. And that when they came to attack the school, the teachers were the first target. In another town called Dambua, they will come to the school, they threaten the teachers to come up with protection money, 200,000 naira. That is almost times 20 of what a teacher earns in Nigeria. And when these teachers could not come up with such money, they would kill you in front of your pupils, in front of the teachers.
In 7 years of clashes between the militants and the Nigerian army, many of the Boko Haram fighters are still at large. But Abrak says the death toll among teachers is high.
When Boko Haram moved from attacking government institutions and started attacking schools, the teachers were the first element of that Boko Haram attack. And in Maiduguri, in Borno State alone, over 500 teachers have been killed.
One of the teachers in the town of Dambua told Abrak about his own brushes with death. He also talked about how some of his school colleagues have negotiated a way to reopen their school with a local safety net.
A lot of his colleagues were killed in front of him because they couldn't come up with protection money. But now, himself and his fellow colleague teachers have had a community meeting with the parents in that village and the vigilantes, and they've agreed that the vigilantes will surround the schools, keep the school protected while they teach.
Abrak says these teachers risk their lives to reopen the schools in internal displacement camps, and they may be attracting young Nigerians who've never been in school before.
If you go to all of the schools in Maiduguri, you find out that most of the population of the students have almost doubled, or in some schools have tripled. And you ask them, they said, yes, we want to go to school. It's because we didn't have access to school. We didn't know what we know today. But now that we know that education is good, we are so happy to be in the classroom. It's so marvelous.
As a reporter, Abrak offers specifics about what he hopes is a positive development for a region that has suffered for many years.
I'm just telling you about a school that I visited. It's a public school called Bulunkutu Primary School. This school used to have about within 3,000 to 4,000 pupils, but now it has about 7,000 pupils. You could see the excitement in the children.
The structure for educational recovery in Northeast Nigeria is complex. Abrak says the help comes from all over the country and the world.
Honestly, a lot of the credit has to be given to the NGOs because, in the first place, the NGOs are the ones that have taken in these people, and also the government. UNICEF has given them kits, you know, they've given them bags, they've given them stationaries, writing materials, and all of that. UNICEF have set up schools in these camps. So I would say that it is these NGO workers, particularly UNICEF, they set up these camps, they set up these schools.
Abrak praises the cooperation between the Nigerian government, UNICEF, and a collection of Nigerian and international NGOs. He also cites the heroic work of teachers.
Let's not forget the teachers. Teachers teaching in these camps are volunteers. And these are teachers whom also have fled from the injustice, so whom also have been targeted. So you see, the teachers have insisted that we will teach them, and teachers are doing it.
Efforts to get children back into the schools in Maiduguri and the surrounding displacement camps is on the right track. However, Boko Haram remains a threat in many areas of Nigeria's northeast. David Arnold, VOA, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Gambia's president-elect Adama Barrow says he is concerned about his safety amid political uncertainty following the December 1st election. And 8 years of violence and conflict in northeastern Nigeria have created one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Children in South Sudan continue to be recruited by military forces and armed groups, according to the International Children's Rights Group, UNICEF. The two largest parties to the conflict in South Sudan, the SPLA and the SPLA in opposition, both signed agreements with the UN to end the recruitment and prevent the use of children in combat. However, with continued conflict, a rise in child soldiers is occurring, with 1,300 children recruited in 2016. This brings the total number of children used in conflict to 17,000 since 2013. James Elder is Regional Chief of Communication for UNICEF in Eastern and Southern Africa. He just returned from a trip to South Sudan and spoke with me about the rise in the recruitment of child soldiers despite the agreement between the warring parties.
I think it's saying that there are agreements that aren't being fully implemented, like all aspects of this conflict. The people most impacted are children. So those agreements around peace accords, those agreements around upholding their own signatories to international law around child recruitment that are not being met are, of course, putting the most vulnerable citizens of South Sudan at more and more risk. And we're seeing that in South Sudan now. We're seeing that in these continuous increases in child recruitment just at a time when, you know, the middle of this year, people were very hopeful that the citizens of the country may finally start to see something like a dividend of peace.
What regions are most affected by this in South Sudan?
This was limited to a couple of states around Unity State, but of course the conflict in various forms has spread from that into the Equatorias. There's been reports of violence in many more areas of the country than we saw even 3 or 4 months ago, which is again another cause of concern for the international community, because it just means that those few places where families were moving to try and get some refuge, to try and get some respite from conflict, also now don't offer, you know, the peace and security that they once did.
What types of abuses are the children experiencing right now?
Unfortunately, the children of South Sudan have experienced almost every abuse that the adult mind can conjure. They are being recruited, and when a child, of course, is recruited, whether or not they're in the front line, they face risk of death. If they're in the front line, then of course they see and sometimes commit unspeakable horrors. Children who haven't been recruited are still in villages that are often under attack. Amid this entire crisis, even those children who have somehow managed to escape violence are living in a state where so
social services are close to collapse. And if it wasn't for, you know, organizations like UNICEF or the World Food Program, then levels of hunger would be even more severe and malnutrition than they are. So children who've even escaped and aren't in direct line of fire are at grave risk of malnutrition, of grave risk of disease, of malaria. Unfortunately, it's a really long list. It's hard to think of a country where kids suffer more. And that's at a time when we realize just that there are many, many countries around the world where children are suffering.
What is South Sudan's government saying about this situation with children?
Well, government remains a partner when we try and work on things like education and trying to get what it would be tens of thousands of teachers trained. South Sudan has the highest portion of children out of school on the planet. The government, I think, acknowledges the enormity of the situation facing children, but at the same time, the UN will make very clear that what is mostly needed right now is peace and access. And the children of South Sudan don't have peace, and some United Nations agencies don't have the access to reach those most vulnerable people. So they're the two things that are most required right now for the kids of this long-suffering, very new nation.
You all have documented that at least 1,300 children have been recruited in 2016. Looking ahead into the next year, what do you see regarding child recruitment?
I wish I had that crystal ball. I think that in the middle of this year, there was increasing optimism among South Sudanese, among those people who work in the country, who work in really, really difficult, dangerous conditions. Of course, the conflict that broke out again in July set children and many others back a long way. What happens in 2017 is, of course, very much up to the government and the opposition forces as to, you know, how best they can really represent the interests of their children. I wish I knew. I certainly know that the dozens and dozens of families that I've met across that country have more resolve and sort of fortitude and resilience in the face of just dire, dire situations. But of course, no one can go on forever when these people have exhausted all coping mechanisms, have sold off what meager assets they've had, are moving around the country, are unable to plant crops. Then 2017 could be a year of even graver food insecurity, again, if violence doesn't stop.
James Elder is Regional Chief of Communication for UNICEF in Eastern and Southern Africa. He spoke with me from Nairobi.
Zimbabwe's finance minister says the nation's public debt has risen by $3 billion in the past year to more than $11 billion. Patrick Chinamasa says the poor economy has caused a worsening of relations with major creditors and limited access to finance. The 2017 budget attempts to reduce Zimbabwe's debt. Zimbabwe has settled its obligations to the International Monetary Fund, amounting to more than $100 million. The repayment in October led to the IMF removing sanctions.
Botswana has begun talks with Zimbabwe and Namibia over the repatriation of more than 1,000 refugees after the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees decided to scale down operations. The UNHCR's decision will leave the Botswana government with an annual $2 million bill for the refugees' upkeep. From Gaborone, Botswana, Martin Gwenya has details.
Botswana argues that the cost of keeping the refugees can only be offset by repatriating them. In this regard, Gaborone has opened talks with Harare and Windhoek for the return of the refugees to their respective countries. The two countries have the highest number of political refugees who live at the Duke refugee camp outside Botswana's second city of Francistown. Namibia has 919, followed by Zimbabwe with 688, while the rest are from Somalia, 312, Burundi, 184, Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania, Uganda, and Eritrea. Botswana's Minister of Defense, Justice and Security, Shokati, recently told the country's National Assembly that UNHCR intends to reduce involvement at the end of the year. This will mean the government has to foot the more than 2,000 refugees costs, estimated at 20 million pula, approximately $2 million every year. Kati says the Botswana government does not think that refugee status should be permanent and that eventually the migrants should be helped to return to their respective countries as a lasting solution. Talks with Harare on the progress of the repatriation are through the two countries' joint commission on security and defense. Some refugees at the Duke camp say they want to be allowed to look for employment opportunities instead of returning to their countries. Oscar Murima says he still fears a return back to Royal Masingo in Zimbabwe after fleeing political persecution in 2008.
We don't feel this is the right time for us to be going home. And again, it's not even appropriate for them to confine us. At least they should allow us to go out and look for employment and work, since some of us are professionals.
He adds life has become unbearable at the camp with reduced food rations since UNHCR announced it will withdraw support.
In the camp, things are getting worse, food-wise, and we are just hoping that maybe the government of Botswana will decide to take care of us. We are not really sure.
UNHCR spokesperson Tina Kelly denies there is hunger at the camp, but confirmed by phone from Johannesburg in South Africa, the refugee agency is pulling out not only in Botswana but several other countries. Namibian refugees fled their country after a conflict over the Caprivi's trip in 1998. They feared persecution from their government for their suspected involvement in a move to secede the strip, now Zambezi region, from Namibia. The majority of Zimbabweans crossed into Botswana at the height of the 2008 political violence, which marked the disputed presidential election. Reporting for VOA's English to Africa service, this is Martin Gwenya in Gaborone, Botswana.
Two separate explosions in the Somali capital today killed at least 7 people. A blast, believed to be caused by an improvised explosive device, tore through a Somali army checkpoint in southwest Mogadishu and a nearby camp for the displaced. Officials say 6 government soldiers were killed. At least 13 other people were reported injured, most of them women and children. In separate incident, a suspected Al-Shabaab suicide bomber detonated a car bomb near a Mogadishu restaurant, killing himself and wounding 7 others, including 1 journalist. The village restaurant is frequented by local journalists, government officials, and visitors from the diaspora. The restaurant has been targeted in several previous attacks, which killed journalists and government staff. A VOA reporter in Mogadishu says the bomber was trying to ram his car into another vehicle carrying a senior police commander. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Botti, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.